giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Tom Stewart. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Ben.
So why don't you maybe start by just giving us a little bit of information about your background?
Okay. Well, I'm a programmer and a computer scientist, a lapsed mathematician. My background is in mathematics and computer science. I work as a Ruby developer and a consultant, so I do quite a lot of trying to help people make better products by making their software better and trying to help out teams with things like test-driven development and stuff like that. I live in London, and it's very nice here, and I, you know, there are a lot of cool people who live in London who have interesting problems and who need help with making software, so I have a pretty good time here, and I've been doing Ruby for probably a decade now, so it's been quite a while that I've been primarily using one language. I'm kind of starting to broaden out a little bit now, but surprisingly many people are still using Ruby for things and Rails for things, so I get to still do a lot of that. That's what I mostly spend my time doing, is helping people who have Ruby and Rails applications.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see, so you've been using Ruby for a long time. It's been interesting to see you talk about monads in Ruby.
Right.
Trying to bring that interesting idea from the FP world, I guess, into Ruby land.
Right. I guess one of the things I've been trying to do over the last few years is trying to take some of those ideas from more formal or more academic or more computer science-y areas or programming languages and trying to bring them into Ruby a bit. I wrote a book a few years ago where I was trying to explain some computer science ideas in Ruby, and that sort of naturally led me down a path of, since I wrote that book, I had a bunch of offcuts and bits and pieces that never made it into the book, and so like I have a big pile of like stuff that I want to explain about computer science and doing it in Ruby, and so Monads was like, you know, eventually reached the top of the stack with that. In fact, that was the thing that people mostly asked me to explain. You know, after I given a talk about some computer science thing, there was always someone who said, well, that was great, but could you just explain monads? And then it's like, oh God, okay. So yeah, I eventually like decided to scale that by just doing a talk about it.
So you have a great talk about it, which I definitely recommend to people. And that's actually, your talks are how we have met actually in the past.
Right.
So we met at conferences, and I've always been a big fan of your talks, and I bought your book and all that.
Oh, thank you.
And that's partly why I wanted to have you on today.
Right.
But if you, your talk was Refactoring Ruby with Monads.
That's right.
Is that the one? That's the Monad talk?
That is it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I gave it a bunch of times, but
I think
it's just the one.
Yeah, so but that's absolutely worth pulling up and watching, and we'll link to that. But I've always enjoyed the way you bring computer science topics into the Ruby world, I guess. So we most recently saw each other at Bath Ruby.
That's right.
And you talked about, I think, what boiled down to like a graph traversal algorithm or something like that.
Well, it was that was definitely part of it. That Bath Ruby talk was something that has been brewing in my mind for quite a long time, and it was good to get it out of my system. It was really... I gave that talk at RubyConf last year, and then so that was kind of a rerun. Yeah, it was about abstraction and mathematics, really. And one of the illustrative examples I used was to do with graph theory, but a bunch of other stuff as well. I was trying to make a slightly larger point about how I think that mathematics is kind of interesting and useful and really applicable to a lot of the things that we try to do. I think that a lot of people who are self-taught or maybe haven't had a more mathematical background have just kind of naturally shy away from those kind of ideas and assume that they're not for them. But of course, everything that we do with computers and as software engineers is fundamentally mathematical, whether we think about it in that way or not. So sometimes it can be useful to remind people of those, you know, that cool stuff that is, you know, the point of that talk really was to try and say that mathematics is just the study of abstraction, and that as computer programmers, we spend all of our time dealing with abstractions. And so that was my attempt to just kind of try and connect those two fields together in a in a way that might make sense to people, not in a, you know, you've got to eat your greens and learn a ton of mathematics, but more like, well, you spend all day thinking about abstractions and figuring out how to plug things together to make larger things so that you can understand complex problems in terms of these simplified abstractions. And that's what mathematics is about as well. I don't know to what extent I managed to convince people of that, but it was fun talking about apples and oranges and graphs and stuff like that. So, you know.
Yeah. So that talk was called A Lever for the Mind, by the way, if you want to check that out. Mm-hmm. And recommend it. I like how you sort of do this unflinching look and say, yes, there's math involved here, but it's going to be okay. Like, I'm gonna walk you through it, and I have, you know, nice slides, and it'll be fine.
Right. Well, I really enjoy that stuff. Like, it's the it's always been the side of computer programming that I find the most interesting and stimulating, I suppose. I think there's a sense in which a lot of the stuff that we do as programmers, the sort of day-to-day stuff, can sometimes not be that stimulating, you know. Mm-hmm. If anyone who has done work using Rails knows that a lot of the things that people build with Rails are just kind of like web interfaces to databases, and so a lot of the time that work is not necessarily very challenging in its sort of intellectual content. I mean, there are always a lot of challenges in terms of how are we going to make this work with, you know, how are we going to deal with all the incidental complexity of making this application? How are we going to deal with browser incompatibilities and network outages and all those kinds of things? But it's not every day that you get to sit down and work on something that's like a really, you know, tough intellectual challenge as opposed to a test of your patience and stamina, you know. So mm-hmm. it's nice just to think about these other aspects of computers that are a little bit more, you know, a little bit more intellectual and a little bit less wrestling with IE6 compatibility. You know, it can sometimes be nice to retreat into that little mind palace and, you know, have a little think about Turing machines or, you know, computability or whatever it is. That's, you know, that's all the stuff that I'm really interested in. And so I like to, when I feel like I'm going to freak out because of the asset pipeline or whatever, it's nice to just kind of have a little think about how amazing computers are and how incredible it is that they're, you know, all of this awesome power that they're unleashing into the universe. And then you go back to like trying to get that rake task to run or whatever. It's a nice balance, I think.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's so important to be able to achieve a positive perspective like that from time to time. Like, if you want to look around the world and notice how everything is broken and bad, it's really easy to do, but it's not going to get you anywhere good.
Yeah, it's difficult to strike the right balance there, because on the one hand, I'm sort of fairly curmudgeonly by nature, so my instinct is to complain about things. And also, I'm British, so, you know, that also plays into my...
I wasn't going to say it. I'm glad you did.
Yeah, you know, it comes naturally to me to find the negative side of every situation and make a complaint about it. And it's very easy to complain, mm-hmm. but it's also quite lazy. And I catch myself doing it all the time, and I'm trying hard to not be so lazy, and when I do feel like I need to complain about something, to try and be constructive about it and try to present. And I mean, in a certain sense, all of the conference talks I've given over the last few years have been thinly veiled complaints about things, but I've been trying to present them in a helpful and positive way. You know, so that talk about abstraction was actually triggered by, this is going back a bit now, but I think maybe last year there was a little round of blog posts and tweets and people talking a bit about how, you know, you don't need mathematics to be a programmer, you know, you don't need computer science to work with computers. And so that talk was primarily, it began as a sort of a slightly curmudgeonly reaction to that thread of conversation, but yes. in the end, I, you know, I hope I managed to turn it around and turn it into something constructive. And I mean, I do see a lot of people, it's, you know, if you open up Twitter any day of the week, certainly the people that I follow on Twitter, you scroll up and down, and it's around about 90% people complaining about their computers and like, oh man, you know, Apple Music just deleted all my tracks, or, you know, Chrome just lost all my tabs, or, you know, I just got a kernel panic and lost all my work or something. And you do see a lot of negativity and pain that are caused by computers, but I really love them. Like, I think computers are brilliant, and I was lucky enough to be able to have access to computers from a young age, and so they've been like a real constant throughout my whole life, which I suppose is normal for, you know, millennials. But for me, I feel like I was extremely fortunate to feel like I was born into a world where there are always home computers, and there was always, you know, BBC Basic that I could write programs in and stuff. So they, for me, they sort of form a really, really crucial part of the fabric of the universe. And
yeah,
I just feel really excited about them. Like, I am, me and some other people in London have started this this book club called London Computation Club, and we meet up every couple of weeks, and we've been reading our way through a few books, and it's just really fun. I really like meeting up with other people who are after a day or a week or a fortnight of toiling in the, you know, in the rails mines or whatever, we still, you know, we still want to get together after work to talk about, oh, let's make a parser, or let's make a, you know, let's make a compiler, let's make a simulator, yep, or whatever. It's really, you know, I find it really, you know, it really enriches my life. I find computers really life affirming. And so I try not to get too lost in that sea of like, oh, computers are terrible. Everything computers, you know, computers are broken. It's like, of course they're broken, but they're also amazing. And hopefully they're going to become less broken, as, you know, they're less broken now than they used to be by some metrics. Mm-hmm. So hopefully eventually we're going to figure out how to make them less broken.
Yeah, see, I love that you took that sort of frustration and let it turn into something good, a talk that teaches people and kind of states your point in a positive way. This is something that I feel like I've stolen from Joe Ferris, our CTO, who has shares a similar viewpoint, which is like, it doesn't do any good to complain about that stuff or like to talk about what you hate. Like, focus on the things that you do like and the things that you do think are good, and just talk about those, you know, all the louder and with the more fervor, and, you know, let people kind of choose where they want to go.
Yeah, right. Well, I think there's something to be said for both of those things. Just to be clear, I do think it's fine to vent, and I think that can be helpful. You know, that's what Twitter's for. Why not open that window and just, you know, type in 140 all caps characters about how you just lost 5 hours of work? Like, that's probably healthy. But at the same time, yeah, it needs to be balanced by like something constructive. I mean, I think a lot of the time, the frustration that people feel with computers is just how inscrutable they are, like how difficult it is to understand what's going on. I mean, I feel that all the time, you know, and I feel like I'm probably in, you know, the top 5% of the population who knows what is going on with computers. And I still find them very confusing and frustrating. And
yeah,
and that's partly why I want to try and diffuse that a little bit by making these little attempts to open little windows onto, you know, that was kind of my hope with the book I wrote, was like, by taking these ideas that people might not have been aware of and presenting them as little fun computer programs, it kind of, and yeah, all of the other stuff I've tried to do as well. I think it's just, I like to think that understanding is the thing that can kind of diffuse that frustration sometimes. That sometimes if you, in fact, in this book club, we've been reading this book, I can never remember the title, but it's, everyone calls it NAND to Tetris. That's not the real title. It's like Foundations of Computing Systems or something is the real title. But that book's great because every chapter takes you, it's basically about building a working computer from scratch. So from the first chapter, it teaches you about NAND gates and shows you how to make logic gates out of NAND gates. And the next chapter shows you how to make higher level components like memory and stuff out of logic gates. And then the next chapter shows you how to make a CPU and so on. And then it shows you how to make an assembler and how to make a virtual machine and how to make a compiler and eventually how to make an operating system. And by the time you get to the end of that book, it really brings it home to you just how much incredible engineering effort and complexity has gone into a computer. And I find that does sort of calm me down a little bit. You know, when something goes wrong with a computer, you can kind of think about, well, it's kind of a miracle that this thing is working at all. So having a little, I think the more you know, the more you're inclined to be patient and be a bit more like, oh, you know, I feel a bit more philosophical about computers. Every time I learn something new, I'm like, oh, wow, that's amazing. Like, I'll cut them a break.
Yeah. Well, when you have more appreciation of like how many levels of abstraction there are that are like each an order of magnitude more complicated than the one below it, or it's just, I think it gives you more appreciation for like, okay, somewhere in this chain, something has gone wrong, but like we're using these just incredibly complicated machines and like, this is just going to happen.
Right. This is just the way it's going
to
be.
And we're all fallible humans trying to write, you know, the best code we can. And sometimes it doesn't work out. And like, that's a bummer, but oh well.
Yeah. Well, it'd be good if the code we wrote wasn't quite so bad, but we're still looking for solutions to that problem.
Definitely. So I've always been a big fan of your talks and I'm impressed at their variety. So like you have a description, let me pull up this description for one of your talks that I love. The talk is, I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea what I'm doing, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. To explain why, I'll touch on evolutionary biology, the imposter syndrome, Dunning-Kruger effect, video games, test-driven development, material exploration, beavers, judo, and Douglas Adams.
Right.
Which is like kind of an awesome little, like, how could you read that and not go to that talk? Kind of a great abstract. But I'm curious what your talk preparation and process is.
Oh, wow. That's a good question. So I usually have, firstly, I have a folder in a Dropbox mm-hmm. where I start, where I'm constantly just, every time I have a vague idea about something that might be interesting to talk about, I go make a new file in there. And then every time I'm in the shower and I have another idea that relates to that thing, I'll go and stick it in there. So these, they tend to gestate for a long time. I mean, mm-hmm. that talk's a really good example, because the reason why that talk is so all over the place in terms of what's in it is because it really did grow very gradually over a period of months, where a load of disconnected ideas that all felt like they had something to do with each other began to sort of stick together in my mind. And I every time I thought of something, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and sort of think, oh, you know, I should mention this thing. I'd go put it in that file. Mm-hmm. But I have a bunch of those, you know, I have a load of them that have never become talks because they just never accumulated enough interesting stuff to be a talk. And then whenever one of those files kind of gets sufficiently large that I open it and look at it and think, oh, there, you know, there's actually a talk here, I should actually do this, then it will graduate to the point where I will, you know, try and write an abstract for it and try and submit it somewhere. And then if it gets accepted, then I enter into the terrifying and stressful phase of actually turning it into a real talk, which mostly happens in an outliner. I use Omni Outliner. And it's the, which is the only way I know how to write, is just to try and figure out what the top level structure of the thing is. So, you know, I'll have all of these scattered notes of just tons of stuff. I'll do this sort of research phase and collect loads of bits and pieces of, like, you know, screenshots from things I've seen, or sentences from books I've read, or, you know, tweets or blog posts or anything that I think is related. And the first step in actually writing the talk is just trying to organize that stuff and move it around. And I do that in an outliner, and eventually, just by moving stuff around, it's kind of like with refactoring, right? Like, a lot of the time you don't know, you know, you don't have a design in mind. You don't really know, in the same way as with code, you often don't know what the actual underlying structure of the thing you're going to make is. It's the same, like, with me writing a talk. I don't really know what the narrative structure of the talk's going to be and how all of these ideas are connected and what it is, you know, how I'm going to present them. But by moving them around and kind of refactoring the structure of the thing, eventually they settle into this kind of low energy state where it feels like all of the relevant things are next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I've done that organization, I then, again, in an outliner, just try and turn it into, you know, I'll write titles for sections, and I'll have, you know, maybe four or five sections for the talk. And then I'll pop open each one of them and try and put titles of subsections and just keep drilling down until it feels like I've got notes for everything I want to say. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, I open Keynote and make it into slides. But I certainly don't open Keynote until it's, you know, pretty late in the day. Pretty much I know what I want to say and how the explanation is going to work, what the structure of it's going to be. And then it's just a question of the sort of grim process of actually, like, choosing a font and making an animation and stuff like that, which takes me an incredibly long time. But because of that, I try not to even open Keynote until I feel like the talk is sort of finished in my mind, and then it, you know, I have to start making it finished in reality.
Yeah, I think that is a really good process, and that organization shows in the final product really, really clearly to me. Like, there's a narrative arc, and each point sort of supports the arc. And it's obvious to me that there was a lot of thought that went into organization. And I think a lot of people could benefit by stealing a little bit of that process. I think sometimes people approach a conference talk like, oh God, what am I going to say for 40 minutes? And they'll just start kind of like blasting stuff out. Or then maybe they just even start like giving it as like their first step. And they're like, okay, let me just try to talk for 40 minutes and see what happens. And
right.
I'll slowly like just like pour more and more concrete onto those things that I've said a bunch of times now. And that'll be the talk.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you think it pays off. I mean, it is a huge amount of work, but like you say, I think it is important. In fact, the other day I read a blog post by Russell Davies at the Government Digital Service here in the UK. He's written a series of blog posts about how to give good talks, and I read one of his posts the other day about how when you give a talk, you're responsible for managing the attention of the audience. He was saying, if you write an article, then people can manage their own attention because they're able to move freely around within the article that you've written. So if your organization isn't very good, then they can compensate for that by choosing which piece they read first and then skipping back and forth and stuff like that. But then when you're in a room with people and you're giving a talk, they don't have any control over the order that you're presenting things in. And so, and I think that's a really good way of thinking about it, is like actively managing the attention of the audience and trying to think, you know, I can't just do a huge info dump here of everything that I know about this subject and let them pick up the pieces in their own time, because their mind is already busy listening and interpreting the words that you're saying. And so you have to be responsible for walking them through that thing and making sure that at each point, you know, each thing follows sensibly from the next thing, and that you don't start boring them, or you don't start, like you say, repeating. You know, those are sometimes the worst talks, where someone is just laying more and more on top of an idea that they've already said. It can, you know, you find yourself zoning out and not really paying attention anymore, and then it's very difficult to enjoy it. Whereas the best talks I've seen are ones where there's a real kind of momentum, in as much as so they start talking, and at each point, everything they say, you're always curious, like, well, what are they going to say next? Like, where are they going with this? What's going to be the next thing? And I think when you can hook people like that, and, you know, almost lead them by the nose through that little story you want to tell, that can be really good. So I'm still learning how to do that, but it's a fun challenge, and it's not entirely dissimilar to programming a computer. I mean, this sounds a little bit sociopathic, but part of what you're trying to do in a talk is to kind of, it's a little bit like programming a computer, right? You're trying to program the mind of the audience to, you know, you've got something you want them to understand, and ideally you would just say the thing that you want them to understand, but the problem is that's not how understanding works. You have to take them on a journey. So it's almost like you have to unfold this little computer program in front of them, that when that executes in their mind, the side effect of that program executing is the understanding that you want them to have. And I find it just as interesting trying to reverse engineer that process of what are the subcomponents of this understanding, and, you know, how do I break it down into small enough pieces that each piece goes down nice and easily, but by the time you've plugged them all together, now you understand the thing. It's no different from trying to teach a computer how to do something, although it is different because humans are different, but, you know, it's it tickles the same part of my brain as, you know, trying to teach a computer how to do something. I think
that's so interesting. I never thought of it that way. I really like that that angle on it. Today's podcast is brought to you and me and all of us and everyone we know by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers for as little as $5 per month. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, I can't remember to take backups when I should. And that's why DigitalOcean has auto backups and snapshots to allow you to easily clone and deploy servers. Even Tom wouldn't lose data on DigitalOcean. Actually, Tom's never lost data. What am I talking about? You can deploy servers in regions all over the world with gigabit speeds and 99.99% uptime, which is several nines, probably more nines than anyone needs, more nines than I need. The servers can have up to 20 CPUs, 64 gig of RAM, 640 gig of SSD hard drive space. That's pretty awesome. That's a lot. That's fast. That's many CPU'd. That's much RAM'd. One-click install for apps like Django, Docker, Drupal, LAMP, GitLab, MediaWiki. These are almost in alphabetical order, but not quite. WordPress, Ghost, Magento, OwnCloud. OwnCloud? You can have your own cloud, it sounds like. You can put a cloud in the cloud on DigitalOcean. There's a new tagline. They should hire me for this. I could do this full time. It's easy to get started. You can deploy in as little as 55 seconds. And if it goes even 1 second over, you can email me and let me know. There's an active community. There's a lot of tutorials. There is an active forum. So if you need help, someone is nearby. But yeah, you should check them out. And if you do, head over to DigitalOcean.com to learn more. When you sign up, I want to ask you to use the code GIANTROBOTS with a capital G and a capital R, a giant G, a giant R, at checkout for a $10 credit toward your new account. So thank you to DigitalOcean for supporting this show. One thing that you said that I want to touch on is you feel like the best speakers kind of gets you into this point where you can't wait to hear the next thing they're going to say, and it feels like it flows sort of logically. And I have a little trick for that, which is if you want it to feel like kind of like a story, you can actually just tell a story.
Right.
Like, stories make amazing talk. One of my favorite talks is Russ Olson's talk, To the Moon.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen this?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, and so for those that haven't, it's discussion of the first time we walked on the moon. Yeah, that must be what it was. Yeah. And it's, you know, starts off like, you know, the rocket's on the pad, or, you know, the rocket's not even on the pad yet. You know, they're like trying to build the rockets. And then, you know, the final step is, you know, we're on the moon.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing, amazing talk. But I think there's a little bit of, not like a cheat, but like there's an advantage built in, which is it is a story. And so, like, you're like, okay, and then what's going to happen? And then this happens. And then this happens. And so if you can I've leaned on that in past talks where it's like, and now I'm just going to tell a 5-minute story. And people, we're just, as humans, we're wired to really enjoy stories.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's kind of an exploit, right? Like you say, it's kind of built into our brains.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are probably a lot of things like that where if I knew more about human psychology, I might be able to trick people in 10 different ways. But like you say, storytelling is a good way to provide that that momentum.
If you walk up to give a talk and the first thing you say is, "I'd like to start with a story," people are like, "Ooh, okay." Like that's like as opposed to like, "Here's where I work and we're hiring, by the way," and yada yada yada.
Yeah, that's one of my that's actually one of my bugbears. I used to be, as I'm getting older, I'm getting more curmudgeonly, and now that's the thing where I feel like I've seen a lot of conference talks now, and now when a talk begins and the first thing that happens is 5 minutes of here's who I am and here's where I work, it's just that little voice in the back of your brain going like, no one cares. Like, yeah. Well, that's unfair. You know, people do care, but at the same time, that's not what you're here to talk about, right? If you do your talk, if it's interesting and I want to know more about you, I'll go check you out on Twitter, right?
Of course.
But that's just,
I read a blog post called Kill Your Introduction, which is basically that.
Yeah, I've been trying to, I haven't seen that post, but that definitely resonates with me. I've been trying to, every time I give a talk, when I started giving talks, I always used to have a slide at the beginning that said who I was and, you know, why I'm here and why I'm talking and stuff. And then that's gradually, that shrunk down to just putting my name and Twitter handle on the title slide. And the last few talks I've given, I haven't even done that. Like my title slide is just the title of the talk. And usually a URL where people can go to see the transcript and stuff, because I always try to write talks up so that there's a written version for people who don't want to or can't watch the video.
Yep.
Which is, I think, very important, but it's also a lot of work, and it's frustrated me in the past where I've done a huge amount of work to write something up, and then you realize that people are finding the talk on YouTube and there's no indication, you know, I can't control the way that videos get presented on conference sites or on YouTube or whatever. So there's no way of, like, particularly if it's on, say, a Confreaks or something, there's literally no way that I can put something there that says, you know, FYI, there's a write-up of this if you want to see it. So now I've started, you know, title slide is just title of the talk, URL where you can find the not yet existent write-up.
So if you
actually go to that URL, you know, as I'm giving the talk, it'll just be a thing that says, this is a placeholder for, you know, the eventual write-up of this talk. But then hopefully once it escapes into the wild and if people find it, then it says right there on the first slide that there's a write-up online. So
yeah, so that's one thing I wanted to talk about, is that you do these full transcripts with, you know, table of contents linked into, you know, deep linked into the topics and, you know, with the screenshots, and it's I'm sure it's reworked from the original transcript, but it's basically like, you know, you're reading the talk instead. And that's such a smart idea. Like, this is something that I don't do. But I think it's so nice when you put this much work into a talk to have like a final thing that's on your site under your control. You know, you can come back and edit it, and people that can't watch the video can, you know, skim it. Google knows about it.
Yeah.
It's a smart thing.
Well, that's the thing. I think it has so many wins. I mean, you know, primarily it's very useful to people who have accessibility issues with video, whatever those might be, and that's not just to do with people who are partially sighted or hard of hearing, but also people who just are in an environment where they can't watch videos. You know, if you're at work and you don't have headphones, or, you know, it's just not socially acceptable to watch a video for 40 minutes or whatever, I think there are a huge number of people who just aren't in a position to be able to sit there and watch a video for that long. And like you say, I think one of the things that does frustrate me about video-only content is just how hard it is to know whether it's worth the investment of time.
Mm-hmm.
Because you land on a page and you can see from the thing that it's like, oh, this is 38 minutes. If I watch this, is it going to be interesting? Am I going to learn something from it? Or is it just going to be stuff I already know? Or is it going to be stuff that I don't know, but that I already can tell I'm not interested in?
Mm-hmm.
And so I like to think that there are people in the world who, when they see that there's a transcript, they just kind of scrub through it and be like, oh, I see there's a section about this, and oh, I can see there's going to be like a cool diagram or an animation, and I can see, oh, there's a little bit of maths there, and there's a little bit, oh, he's going to talk about Douglas Adams for a bit or whatever. And then I just hope that even people who will watch the video, it functions as, like you say, Google can find it, but also, you know, even people who've directly come to it, you're providing people with a lot more information with which they can, you know, make an informed decision about whether they're going to watch the thing. And even I recorded one episode of a podcast. It was so much work. I haven't done another one, but you know, the one episode of the podcast I made, most of the work, you know, it took 2 hours to record, but then it took me several days to transcribe it and, you know, have a full transcript. But like, again, I mean, who's going to sit down and listen to like an hour and a half of me talking to someone else unless they can actually look at what we're going to be talking about? Because otherwise it's like, it's just asking people to take a gamble that, you know, an hour and a half of their time is going to be worthwhile. I mean, if you're, you know, if you're Sandy Metz or something, you can get away with it. But if you're me, you really need to, sell this stuff so that people feel like there's a reason.
Or you can just come on an established podcast that people will listen to serially anyway.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So I need to find myself an uncritical audience of mindless consumers.
Whoa. You cannot come on the podcast and trash the audience. That's rule number one.
No, I think that's a smart idea. So this is working out pretty well.
Right. Exactly. And you don't even have to write a transcript for this one.
No. Excellent.
That's actually something we've looked into, is to getting the podcast transcribed. Like, I actually would love to have that, but we certainly, like you said, it's very time consuming to do yourself, and it seems like the outsourced things are not super cheap, and then even when you do them, they require a lot of correction.
That's the experience I had. I tried paying a couple of services to do transcripts for me, and it doesn't help that it's always technical. You know,
right,
when
exactly.
If it was a normal speech, then maybe that would be different. But when you're trying to, and especially, you know, those transcription services are always either very expensive, in which case I guess you're paying for, you know, very highly trained, I don't know what the word is for transcription people, but you're, you know, you're paying people where it's their only job and they've like, you know, gone to college for it, or the services that are more affordable, I imagine it's just sort of part-time people, you know, people who are doing it for a bit of cash on the side, and they're not necessarily trained in transcription. And yeah, they get a lot of stuff wrong. And the other thing, it doesn't really apply to podcasts, but certainly the transcripts of the talks, I found it's a huge amount of work just to, even when I've done the transcript and I've cleaned it up and taken out all the ums and ers and, you know, punctuated it properly, there's still quite a step from that cleaned up transcript to something that reads coherently as an article. It's a different medium. Mm-hmm. So I often have to do quite a lot of work to just go in and say, well, you know, this stuff that made sense when I was talking in front of slides, it really needs more detail or less detail, or really it would make more sense now I look at it again if the explanation was in a different order, or if actually if I need to have a segue that connects this thing to this thing, or, you know, stuff like that. So I often spend a lot of time not just doing the transcript, but also not rewriting, but effectively editing the content to make it more appropriate for a blog post, instead of just, you know, I don't want it to just be, here is a literal record of the words that came out of my mouth. I want it to be, here is a, you know, I've ported it to a different medium, and that's involved making a bunch of changes to make it more palatable to someone who's reading.
Yeah. So I'm familiar with this thing of needing to sort of clean it up, because I interviewed Tom Lehman, who's the CEO of Genius.com, and they ended up getting that interview transcribed so they could put on the site and annotate it. And suddenly I learned that I use the word like way too often.
Right.
Like it's hundreds of times in the document, and it's just like, oh my, this is terrible. Let's never transcribe this again. I don't want to know of these things.
Yeah, there's nothing. It's not. I don't think it's very good for one's ego to ever like. Oh, see, I'm doing it. to ever have to read a transcript of the way you've spoken or watch a video. I mean, this is a painful thing. Of like, I always try to watch back videos of talks I've given, and it really is very painful. I don't enjoy hearing my own voice or watching myself talk. I find it very embarrassing, but it's good, because every time I watch it, I notice another annoying thing that I do, and then I have to, and then on the presenter notes on slide one of the next talk I give, in all caps, it says, stop doing that annoying thing that you do. so
it's so worth it. Yeah, when I've watched my old videos, I definitely always pick up stuff and like, or like, oh, that's just not even really true, I should really change this part because that's not a thing.
Yeah,
it's worth the pain, in my experience. So I want to change topics just a little bit. So this is kind of like almost an unfair question to ask someone who wrote an entire book about computer science, the Understanding Computation book. But do you feel like there's a subset of really useful CS topics, computer science topics, for the average like working programmer to learn?
That's an interesting question. Well, basically, yes. but that doesn't seem like the answer that you want. I think there is, but I also think it depends on what you want to get out of it. I think implicit in that question is a sort of vocational angle, which is like, what stuff should you learn if you want to be a better programmer? And I think that that is the stuff that I am possibly not as interested in, although I do think it has a lot of value. So there's a lot of, an example would be just basic data structures and algorithms. I think like if your job is to write programs, then you're going to find it easier if you have a basic grasp of what the tools available to you are. You know, if you, and I'm not talking about sophisticated stuff, I'm just saying, you know, if you know what a binary tree is and what a linked list is, and you know, what's the difference between an array and a vector and a list and all those kinds of things, like not super sophisticated. I don't think there's any point in like learning all the sort algorithms or learning, you know, going too deep on all of that stuff and, you know, big O notation and things. But I think that there probably is a lot of low hanging fruit. If you gave me a room of 50 people who were self-taught developers who'd never done any academic computer science.
Yep.
I don't actually know off the top of my head, but I'm fairly sure I could give them a list of 10 things, you know, that will make you a better developer if you know about them. And it, just because these things crop up all over the place, right? If you don't know more than the basics of trees, if you know, if you, because everything turns out to be a tree, you know, every program you write is always full of trees. And so if knowing a few like algorithms for traversing trees and what some of your options are for processing those things, I think, and that still falls under data structures and algorithms. But I mean, to answer a different question that you didn't ask, I also think there's a different, not necessarily disjoint set of things that are just interesting. And I think that that's just as important. Like the reason why I wrote that book about, I mean, that book's all about computation theory. And basically there's, when I was trying to sell that book to people, I would always say, you know, there's nothing in this book that will make you a better programmer. You know, this is not, and particularly trying to get O'Reilly to publish it. You know, a lot of the books they publish are extremely pragmatic, in as much as, you know, I want to get a, you know, I'm a Perl developer, but I want to get a job as a Ruby developer. So can you sell me a book that will tell me everything I need to know about Ruby or about Cucumber or RSpec or whatever it is? You know, a lot of their books are just, I need to know about X. Tell me about X so that I can say that I have that skill. And my book doesn't really have anything like that. And it's all very like, what I hope is interesting stuff. And the reason I'm bringing this up is not just to keep constantly talking about my book, but the reason why I wrote that book is because I think that every programmer should have some understanding of what it means, of what computation is and what the limitations of computation are and where computation comes from. And, you know, all of those things where it's like, it may not directly make you better at your job. You know, you may not be any more productive, or you may not write code that is cleaner or more maintainable, or you may not work more effectively with the other people in your team. But I think it is nice to have a kind of, so those are, yeah, I could probably make two different lists of topics. And one of them is like, okay, you're short of time and you just want to get a better job. Here is a list of things that if you know them, you will probably, you know, yeah, data structures and algorithm stuff, you know, basic programming language theory stuff, I think is useful. And, you know, just a grasp of, you know, how programming languages work. And after you type those five lines of Java and click that button in your IDE, like what basically is happening there, you know, what does that button in your IDE do? But I also think that that sort of enriching content is quite important, you know, for the same reason that the arts are important. You know, you don't, no one gets a, well, very few people get a better job by, you know, going to the ballet or going to the cinema or going to an art museum or something. But those things are a very important component of being a human being, and they don't necessarily have to be justified in a commercial way. And so that's how I feel about a lot of the content of computer science, is that I think it is in the same category as all those other things. And I think that it's the intellectual beauty of that stuff is something that we as computer programmers are uniquely positioned to be able to appreciate. Like when I go to an art gallery, I do try to stand and look at paintings, but I'm acutely aware that I don't really know how to appreciate art on anything other than a fairly superficial level, because I don't have the education. And so the reason why I spend so much time obsessing over these minutiae of computer science is because, well, this is one area where I do have the education and I do have the, you know, the ability to be able to appreciate what's so cool about Gödel's incompleteness theorem or whatever it is. And so that's where I get my you know, I don't know what the word is, but that's where I get my satisfaction from, is by learning about those things that aren't necessarily going to make my Ruby method names any clearer, but they certainly make me feel more fulfilled in my, you know, in my choice of career, which is, you know, which does have value, because it means I don't just flip my desk over and go and become a farmer, right? Like, as long as I can maintain that balance between frustration and enlightenment, then I'll kind of be able to keep showing up every day and doing the typing in Vim, which is what it's all about.
Yeah. So in Tom Stewart's world, computer science is a liberal art and would be taught like that alongside.
I think so. Well, that Steve Jobs thing about being at the intersection of the liberal arts and technology, like, yeah. I think that is a really interesting sweet spot. So that's where I think that stuff lives, is like at that crossroads. I think that's where I find all of the most interesting stuff.
Awesome. So we're getting close to time, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk about the book you're writing.
Oh, thank you. So I'm writing a book called How to Write a Web Application in Ruby. I've been writing it for quite a long time now,
Did you just misspell Rails? Because it's...
Well, it's... yeah. So that book it's become a weird project, because I think I announced it nearly 2 years ago on Ruby Rogues that I was going to write it. And that was before I'd written a single word. That was just to force myself to take it seriously. I figured if I said it on a podcast, then it would definitely happen. but what actually happened is that because I'm self-publishing it, it's just become, it gets lower priority than everything else. So it lives in a folder on my hard drive, and every so often I will pop open the file and I will like move some stuff around, and I'll write a sentence or two, and I'll take a screenshot, and I'll tweak the code, and then I'll close it, and then it doesn't get any love for another week. So it's kind of a slow process. But the reason I'm writing that book is because I think it's interesting to, this ties back to something I was saying earlier, which is that I think it's interesting to try and understand what is going on in the software that you're writing and the systems that you're using. So that book is about the first half of the book is, let's write a web application just using Ruby and the standard library. So no gems, no external dependencies. What does it mean to be a web application? And in the case of the book, it says, well, you know, that's, you accept incoming connections on a TCP port, and then you read HTTP requests off of it, and you parse out all the information, and then you send a response back that's got HTML in it and all the right headers and all that kind of stuff. So the first half of the book is just from nothing building up to a fully fledged web application that talks to a database and all that stuff. And then the second half of the book is refactoring all of that messy code out of the way by replacing pieces of it with third-party code. So by saying, all of this stuff that's doing all of this HTTP parsing and header generation, all that stuff is just busy work, because you can use Rack, you know, you can use Puma or something like that. And all of this stuff that we're doing where we look at the contents of the HTTP request and decide which part of the program we're gonna send that request to, we can just replace that with Action Dispatch from Rails. And this thing where we're manually building up strings of SQL, we can replace that with Active Record. And this thing where we've got a huge string with loads of interpolation in it to render some HTML, we can replace that with Action View and stuff. So it's partly a way of showing how web applications work under the hood by making you do it yourself. And then it kind of segues into an explanation of how Rails works by showing you what each of the individual pieces are and how they get plugged together to make a working web application. So the theory is that it will help people who have maybe got into web application development by reading, say, Agile Web Development with Rails, and they know how to type belongs to in an Active Record based subclass, but they've never really pulled that thing apart and figured out how all the pieces are plugged together. So I kind of want to show that in a slightly labored and complicated way. But, you know, I will finish it eventually, and then someone will be able to look at it and tell me whether it's interesting or not.
Have you thought about opening it up?
Well, yeah, my friends, I'm pretty much every week I'm at the pub and complaining to my friends about how difficult it is to write something in a vacuum. You know, when you're writing software in a team, the reason it's so addictive is because you get this constant feedback, right? You know, someone tells you about a feature they want at 10 a.m. and by 11 a.m. you've written all the tests, and by 12 you've made all the tests pass, and by 1 you've pushed and deployed, and you know, by 2 they're happy. It's very satisfying to get that feedback, whereas writing a book is just me in a room kind of sobbing at a text editor. So yeah, that people are always suggesting that I open it up, and I've started thinking seriously about how to do that, because I think that would provide me with a bit more motivation to finish it.
Although
it does provide me with motivation to finish it when people go to rubywebapp.com and type their email address in, so that I can see that Google spreadsheet filling up with people who are interested. So that's a very subtle call to action. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it being done. Looking forward to like shipping it and not having to think about it anymore.
It says it will be published in 2015 here.
It does say that, but what you can't see is that that number has changed twice. So, if you go to, you know, archive.org and check back through time.
That's very honest of you, but not very good sales pitch.
No, I know. I am gonna finish it this. If it's not done by the end of this year, then I think I need to resign myself to the fact that it's never gonna be done. So.
I think you would probably get almost equal joy with just like shooting it or publishing it. Like,
Deciding,
I'm not going to do this, or
get it out. Well, you know, there's a lot of sunk cost there, but you know, I don't want to fall foul of the. You know, I don't want to sink twice as much effort in, but
named after that, I believe.
Right, so. Exactly. But the problem is that the reason why I wanted to write it is because I think it's a cool idea, and it's only a small idea, and it should be small and simple and fun, but I think it's good. So that's the thing that's preventing me from taking it out back just yet, is that I want it to exist in the world. But maybe the more I talk about it, maybe someone will just like steal that idea and do it better. And then, you know, that's 90% of the benefit right there. So I'm not precious about these things. It'll be fine.
Okay, awesome. Well, I think that's a great place to stop. Thanks for coming on. It's been fun talking to you.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Do you have an upcoming conference appearance that people could, or that I could go see?
No, I mean, I am speaking at the London Ruby User Group next month. So for listeners in London, I'm going to be talking about relational programming in Ruby. So I'm kind of excited about that. But other than that, no, I'm keeping my conferences have kind of eaten my brain over the last couple of years. So I'm taking a break for the rest of the year. So nothing big coming up.
So our CEO, Chad, is in London right now. So maybe Chad.
He is. I met Chad at the last LRUG. So Chad, come to the next LRUG and watch my talk.
Okay. Awesome. So today's show was produced and edited by Tom Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/157. Thanks for listening.